We finally learn why Ingenuity crashed. Gaia is nearing the end of its life. NASA is planning cargo deliveries to the moon and a twin of the Milky Way seen in infancy by Webb. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. On January 18th, 2024, NASA's Mars Ingenuity helicopter took its 72nd flight in Jezero Crater on Mars. But little did people realize this would be the final flight of Ingenuity. The helicopter rose to an altitude of 12 meters, hovered, captured a bunch of images of its surroundings. At 19 seconds, it started to descend. And then, at the 32-second mark, it lost all communication with Earth. Engineers tried to figure out what happened. Then they were able to get pictures from Ingenuity, and they could see that its rotors were broken. Follow-on images from Perseverance showed that it was in a very bad state. The helicopter had crashed. Now, I always expected that Ingenuity would crash into a tree, which is the end of all of my drones, but apparently it crashed into the sand. And so the question was, what happened? Why did Ingenuity crash? And so for most of this year, NASA engineers have been trying to figure out what were the series of events that led to its crash. Now, one of the big hints came with the fact that Ingenuity was flying in a region of Jezero Crater that was very sandy, and there weren't a lot of visual features on the surface around it. That's how the helicopter did its navigation. It was looking for rocks and other features on the surface of Mars that it could use to then visually navigate itself around. But the area of Jezero Crater that it was in was very smooth, just sand, and there were a lot of fairly steep sand dunes all around it. Wasn't able to figure out exactly where it was. It wasn't able to figure out how far away it was from the surface, and so it crashed. And it looks like it happened at around the 20-second mark. It was trying to find features to determine its altitude, and it wasn't able to find them. And so what they think happened was that when it landed on the sand, it landed on an incline. And it wasn't designed to handle that excessive load on the rotors, which caused them to snap off. And so that's it for Ingenuity. I mean, it was only supposed to fly a handful of times and ended up flying 72 times. It showed us that sending a helicopter to the surface of Mars is a great idea, mandatory for future missions. If they don't send a helicopter on any future mission to Mars, I think they're going to be missing something. So there will be some lessons learned for future missions. Hopefully they'll have much better navigation systems on board to avoid this mistake, and instead they'll be looking for the trees to finally crash into. Also, an interesting fact, it's not dead. It's still functioning. It just can't fly anymore. And occasionally it sends messages back to Perseverance. The rover and the helicopter are still communicating with each other as Perseverance gets farther and farther away. The end of Gaia. Now, I won't shut up on this channel about how much I love the Gaia spacecraft. This is the mission from the European Space Agency that's measuring the velocity, the distance, and the composition of countless stars in the Milky Way. And so many really interesting science papers have come out of this, looking at the motions of white dwarfs, seeing how various galaxies merged into the Milky Way and are still being digested. But Gaia, like many spacecraft, has a limited amount of propellant on board, and it is running out. And so we now know that we've reached pretty much the end of the life for Gaia. The mission is going to complete its science operations at the end of January 2025. It's going to send all of its final remaining data home, and then in March or April of 2025, ESA is going to passivate the spacecraft. Now, what that means is they're going to push it into a new orbit that keeps it out of potentially colliding with any other spacecraft in the area. Remember, it's at the Earth-Sun L2 Lagrange point, which is a fairly large area. Without propellant, it's going to drift away from this point. And ESA wants to make sure that it's not going to crash into something else down the road. And so that'll be the end of an era. And right now, there are no follow-on missions to Gaia planned, which, you know, I keep asking people about this. The idea that has the most traction is a version of Gaia that has infrared. And so it will be able to look at objects that are cooler and dimmer than all of the stars that Gaia saw. And that would be really useful. That would tell us where the brown dwarfs are, where the red dwarfs are, maybe rogue planets, things like that. So hopefully we'll see another version of Gaia coming up. Now, is Gaia beyond rescue? Probably. Nobody has any plans to go out to the L2 point, try and dock with Gaia and try to service that mission. But it is theoretically possible. And so people at the University of Illinois did did a research study where they tried to figure out what would be the best way to service a spacecraft that is out at L2. And when you think about it, it's very tricky business because as your spacecraft is attempting to dock with a telescope out at L2, it's going to be firing a propellant. That propellant could impact the telescope and cause damage to it. In the paper, the researchers proposed that you could attach to Gaia a sort of spider-like additional module that have its own power, more propellant, and would give the spacecraft a new lease on life. But this is just like a theoretical idea, not anything practical that anybody is planning. And I know, like, why don't they send Starship out to go and rescue? Well, Starship doesn't fly that far yet. Couldn't they send Space Launch System? I mean, it would cost more to launch Space Launch System than to launch multiple Gaia. Gaia is going away, and we all have to be okay with that. So thanks, Gaia. More cargo deliveries for the moon. Now, we're all very focused on the upcoming human missions to the moon as part of the Artemis project. Artemis 2, where team of four astronauts are going to do a flyby of the moon. Artemis 3, where humans are going to set foot on the moon again for the first time in 50 years. But this is just the beginning, and NASA is planning several additional Artemis projects after that. They've already booked a lot of the equipment, they've already ordered the rockets, and now we're getting a much better sense of what some of NASA's future plans are for the moon. And one of their big requirements is to be able to deliver large amounts of cargo to the surface of the moon. And they've been writing technical papers about their requirements for several months. We've been reporting on this quite a bit on Universe Today. And this week we got a more formal designation from NASA on what they're looking for. They want two cargo deliveries. One, they're probably going to be going with SpaceX. One, they're going to be going with Blue Origin. And for cargo, one is going to be the Japanese-built pressurized rover that the astronauts will be able to drive around on the surface of the moon for probably weeks and not have to be in a spacesuit. And then the other big cargo that NASA wants is called the Lunar Surface Habitat. And so this is going to be a more permanent habitat on the surface of the moon. Now, we probably won't see these cargo deliveries until some of the higher numbers of the Artemis missions. And of course, you know, with the upcoming change in administration and with the influence of people like SpaceX, we don't know what the future holds for Artemis. But if this continues on, we could see these large payloads making their way to the surface of the moon. Fine-tuning the mass of the Milky Way. A long-standing question is, what is the mass of the Milky Way? And it's pretty tricky because you are inside the Milky Way right now. How do you measure the mass of your house when you're inside? You don't know how much house is outside your house if you're inside your house. Same problem we have with the Milky Way. Now, researchers have come up with more than a dozen ways to measure the mass of the Milky Way. And a lot of it is about the movements of things passing around in the Milky Way. As you measure the movements of stars, it tells you the mass of the thing that they are orbiting, the Milky Way. But how do you distinguish between how much is baryonic matter, stuff like atoms, you, me, stars, and how much is the dark matter portion of the Milky Way? And these are still unknown questions. But in general, astronomers estimate that the Milky Way weighs about a trillion solar masses. And, you know, the error bars are give or take a few hundred billion times the mass of the sun. And so back to that question of how much is baryonic matter? How much is dark matter? And so one component of the baryonic matter is these high velocity clouds that are orbiting around the Milky Way. And astronomers have estimated that they could be up to 10% of the mass of the Milky Way. Well, a new study just came out that measured the movements of these high velocity clouds in the Milky Way and watched how they interact with other features in the Milky Way. And they've set that estimate way down. And so now they think that in fact, these clouds probably only account for less than a tenth of a percent of the baryonic mass of the Milky Way. So just continuing to chip away bit by bit, figuring out what is the total mass of the Milky Way. Every week we do a vote on our channel where you tell us what you thought was the best space news of the week. And the winner this week was the announcement of NASA's new administrator, Jared Isaacman. So thank you everybody who voted this week. Now we will post the new poll onto our YouTube channel in the community tab within about a day of when we post this news. But of course, if you're just scrolling on YouTube, you should see the poll show up. Go ahead, take a second, interact with that, train the algorithm, subscribe to the channel, comment on all our videos, send them to your friends. That's how more people will find out what we're doing. Super flares, once a century. We are in solar maximum now, which means that we are seeing the most activity on the surface of the sun. And this is going to decline as the sun continues its regular 11-year cycle to get towards solar minimum. And then we're going to see the least amount of activity on the sun, and then it's going to rise. And one of the things that you see during solar maximum is more solar flares, more coronal mass ejections, and more auroras. It is the best time to be looking at the sun. But we know that the sun has a dark side. I mean, can the sun have a dark side? The sun has no dark side. But the sun has a dark side, and that is that it can fire off more catastrophic flares. And of course, the classic example is the Carrington event, which happened in the 1800s, where a solar flare hit the Earth and it was so powerful that people saw auroras around the equator, that telegraph poles lit on fire, that this was a very serious demonstration of what the sun is capable of unleashing. And astronomers have seen other flares off the surface of the sun that are the same magnitude as the Carrington event. They just weren't pointed at the Earth. They were just headed off into space and hit some other planet or star system far away. And there are some events that are so powerful that the record of them is measured in the tree rings that have been found over the last few thousand years. And the Carrington event isn't one of them. They are more powerful than the Carrington event. And so how often do stars like our sun produce these kinds of solar flares? Well, researchers have an incredible data archive, and that is all of the observations made by NASA's Kepler mission. Astronomers recently went through Kepler data. They looked at 56,450 stars observed by Kepler. Because Kepler was looking at a large field of stars and saw many of them for long periods of time, they were able to count up 220,000 years of stellar activity across all of the stars, across all of that catalog. And then they were able to figure out how often stars like our sun tend to give off killer solar flares. And the answer is about once a century. So about every 100 years, a star like our sun gives off a very powerful, kind of deadly flare, like the Carrington event. And so that roughly matches the kind of observations that we have made. And so we should expect to see something that powerful, not necessarily in our direction. Like, this is the key. They can go in, you know, the sun is a ball, it can go in any direction. Very few of those directions are pointed directly at the Earth. But those super flares can happen on a regular basis, even with a star like our sun. Another clue about ultra-high energy cosmic rays. Now, I talk a lot about cosmic rays on this channel, but mostly with their impact, pardon the pun, on space exploration. These are some of the highest energy particles in the universe. You've got particles that, you know, mostly they're just protons accelerated to nearly the speed of light, but they can be heavier, all the way up to iron. And when these pass through our bodies, they deliver an enormous energy punch that can break apart our DNA, and then that can lead to cancer down the road. We are mostly protected here on Earth by the magnetosphere, but once you go out into space, you have no protection, and so you experience much higher levels of this cosmic radiation. And this is going to be like one of the thorniest problems that we face in space exploration. But for scientists, the question is, how can these be possible? Also, this is kind of a good reason why things like, say, the Large Hadron Collider can't destroy the Earth, because it can't produce particles that are as high energy as the cosmic rays that are striking the Earth all the time. You know, once we cross that line and get to above 10 million times what the LHC can produce, then we might have a problem. And so what causes them? How can you get that much energy? Now, it used to be thought that there was some kind of shock acceleration. So you would have a supernova or colliding neutron stars or the accretion disk around a black hole, and it would somehow be able to accelerate these particles to these incredibly high energy states, you know, just a fraction below the speed of light. But another possibility is that it has something to do with magnetic fields. And now a new paper has gone into calculating the kinds of particles that should be generated by magnetic fields and finds that tends to better match the observations. And so instead of necessarily a shockwave coming off of a supernova that's striking particles, accelerating them, instead you've got magnetic fields that are twisting and turning in a very extreme environment, like around a black hole or a neutron star. And then you get these tumbling reconfigurations of the magnetic field, and that snaps away particles out into space that could then be delivered with that much energy. And it seems like that might be the better answer for where these ultra high energy cosmic rays are coming from. But the mystery continues. An early twin of the Milky Way. The James Webb Space Telescope has recently observed a fascinating galaxy seen as it was only 600 million years after the Big Bang. Normally, this would be really hard for Webb to examine, but fortunately, this galaxy was behind a much larger galaxy cluster that acted like a natural telescope lens, a gravitational lens. And so astronomers were able to see this galaxy, although distorted, in unprecedented detail. And in fact, they were able to see this galaxy and see star clusters orbiting around this galaxy. And based on their calculations, astronomers think that this galaxy is very similar to what the Milky Way probably looked like at that point in the history of the universe. Because of the star clusters orbiting around the galaxy, astronomers have nicknamed it the Firefly Sparkle Galaxy. Isn't that a My Little Pony character? And so when you think about the Milky Way today, it's 100,000 light years across. Well, this galaxy, one of its companions is only 6,500 light years away. The other is 42,000 light years away. So you could fit both of these companions within the size of the Milky Way. So it's much smaller. And yet, thanks to this gravitational lens, astronomers are able to study it and really get a sense. And I like what makes me so excited is like, this is what Webb was born to do, to answer these questions. What did the Milky Way look like at the beginning of the universe as the building blocks were coming together to form the large galaxy that we see today? And now astronomers have found one example of these galaxies with the building blocks coming together. It's amazing. Hubble revisits humanity's first quasar. In 1963, astronomers realized that what they thought was a star was actually a galaxy 2.5 billion light years away. They were able to match the observations of the star with radio emissions coming from around it, and they were able to then use that to calculate the distance to this galaxy. They called this object a quasi-stellar object, a quasar. But they didn't know what it was, and there were many exotic explanations for what could cause a quasar. And in fact, if you go back and watch Cosmos, there's a point where Carl Sagan is talking about quasars, and they don't really know what they are. Well, now we know they are supermassive black holes that are actively feeding on material around them. So this object that I mentioned, the one that was discovered in 1963, is called 3C273. And recently it got an update from the Hubble Space Telescope. And what's great about Hubble was it was able to block the bright light from the central core of the galaxy and then reveal fainter features around that. And so it was able to see a new core jet at the center of the galaxy, core blob, and then other blobs. And so just like lots of other features and structures around this. And of course, you can see this giant jet that is blasting out of the galaxy, out into interstellar space, intergalactic space. And so it's great to see this piece of astronomy history then updated by the Hubble Space Telescope. When is it going to get its Webb photo? All right, I'm going to talk about who I would love to interview. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, Andrew Gross, Barely Grooving, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, James Clark, Jerry Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Paul Rohrbach, ScienceWorldRecord.org, Spiderswap.io, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. So a question that I get asked a lot of people is, who would be my dream person to be able to interview? And the reality is that I don't have a good answer for that. I think people are expecting that I'm going to mention some celebrity, but I don't want to interview a celebrity. The people that I love to interview the most are the researchers who are doing the work right now, who are in the middle of it, who are well-spoken, able to communicate, have a passion for the work that they're doing, and they would love to explain to an interested layperson what it is that they're working on. Ideally, they have a really nice audio setup as well. And so I know there's a lot of people who are scientists, early career scientists, people who want to be science communicators that are watching this channel today. And like, I would love to interview you if you are working on research and you think that you have an interesting story to tell and you have a good audio setup, or I can help you with that. Feel free to reach out and let me know who you are and what you're working on. I can't guarantee that I'll have time to interview you, but you know, that'll save me the time from having to hunt you down so that we can do an interview. And so if you want a great example, we were talking about ways to clean off regolith off of astronauts, and I mentioned some research into using liquid nitrogen, and one of the researchers behind that work posted that they had done this work and if I wanted to interview them, and I did, and it was awesome. So yeah, like if you're a scientist and you're watching this, reach out, let me know, and I would love to be able to interview you. Now, of course, we've got lots of really great interviews, and one of the new things that we're doing is giving you, the viewers, a chance to tell me some of the questions that you have for the researchers. And of course, we've got that available on our Patreon for free. You don't have to become a member. You can just access that for free and give me your recommendations. All right, we'll see you next week.